years ago, exactly, actually, January 2004, and you were in a very different building. I hear you still have that building. It was very nice. It had this whole game area, which I haven't found here yet, but I'm told there are game areas around. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be back. And I think if Lee was introducing me, he would probably say I'm an astronomer, which I really like when you say that. We have a telescope, the observatory, the Auger Observatory, that I will be describing to you about. And we have a large collaboration which includes theorists. And until a year ago, when we had very few big challenging results, theorists were very welcome into digging into the data and trying to figure out what's going on. Now we are looked very suspiciously upon because they are all wondering if we have some secret theory that as soon as the data's out, we will be explaining the world. So it's got really exciting. So since I know this is a room full of theorists, it's sometimes good to be inside and sometimes good to be outside. I don't think there's a perfect combination, but I enjoy being inside quite a bit because to me it was very interesting to know how things are measured and what things I should take for real and what can I ignore, because as you will see, there was a lot of debate in the field about pretty much data that we didn't know how to analyze well. So obviously, if you want to produce a lot of theoretical papers, you probably want to be outside so that any bad data that is around you can play with for a while until it gets to the next experiment. But being inside made me a little more economical on ideas in a way, because you know which things to trust better and which not to. So I'll give you a little bit of some of the techniques, but mostly some of the results and how they all fit into the field. I know you had one talk during a workshop by Aaron Chow, who has probably shown a lot of the things I've shown here. So if you've seen that before, you might have questions for him that you can ask me. But you might also be seeing some things you've seen before, so you can take a break and come back. So the big news from last year, November 2007, was us making the cover of Science. And to me, it was very nice to see that we were also chosen as one of the top 10 topics in Science, just after two biology papers on genetics. So you know, there's still room for us to be on the top 10. And it is really a historical event, because for almost 100 years, since 1912, when cosmic rays were shown to be cosmic, we had zero anisotropies in the distribution of particles coming from the sky. Okay, so basically, this is the first time ever that we see an anisotropic distribution in the sky, and that is the beginning of clues to try to figure out what is doing the acceleration of these particles, how do they get to be such high energy, and what are the sources, and all kinds of other questions we can start asking. So the cover of Science was about this correlation that we see between the highest energy events of the Auger Observatory, which are the highest energy events, period. These are all between 10 to the 19 and 10 to the 20 electron volts particles, and a correlation between the distribution of these arrival directions in the sky and of active galactic nuclei. Now, we don't know for sure, we don't really know at this point, if the active galactic nuclei are actual sources of cosmic rays. We know they correlate, but at this level of statistics, we can't really tell anything else too precise about it. So for example, the active galactic nuclei distribution in the sky correlates with large-scale structure, correlates with dark matter distribution, it correlates with galaxy distribution. So it could be other sources that are just easier to detect on the AGN catalog, but it would be actually showing from other sources. So it should be very careful about interpreting this as showing that AGN are the sources, which is what has come out in the news, for example, Nature articles and such. Nature discussion articles, more like the press. So what I want to do, and hopefully have time for discussion, is give you a little bit of background on the high-energy cosmic rays physics that we are interested in understanding, then talk about the observatory that we are part of, trying to really nail this question down, the recent results and some implications and future plans for the field. So high-energy cosmic rays, I'm sure you all remember when the cosmic rays were our part of accelerators. So back in 1953, most of you weren't born, but you know that by that time, many, many particles were discovered using cosmic rays. This is before we had our own accelerators. So cosmic accelerators were the beam that was used to do particle physics up to the early 50s, and all these particles were discovered by putting detectors and have cosmic rays hit their detectors. then, after that time, it was much nicer to control particle interactions in the laboratory, so making bigger and bigger accelerators like delta C was the way to go. While at the same time, astrophysics tried to explain how these particles were generated, and many theories were developed, but given the fact that for the lower energy cosmic rays, we really had no information about anisotropies in the sky, it was, and still is, very hard to really nail what are the sources of these cosmic rays. Okay? Now, the reason why it's hard to see anisotropies is because these are charged particles and they're magnetic fields all over the universe, including in the galaxy. So you need to reach very high energies for the magnetic fields not to bother the particles that much, so that you're able to point back to the sources. And this is what we're seeing. Now, what can we observe in principle? So we can observe the spectrum of cosmic rays, the composition. We can do indirect composition studies. We can't, for the very high energy ones, we can't really hold them in our hands. The lower energy ones, we can, because the flux is very high. But for very high energies, the flux is so low that you see indirect measures of composition. I'll show you some of those. And the sky distribution. The sky distribution until last year was isotropic, and that, again, is due to magnetic fields. So even if, for example, low-energy cosmic rays, and by low-energy, I mean something like up to 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 electron volts, if those things are accelerated in our galaxy, you would not see the galactic plane, because magnetic fields in the galaxy make the orbits of these, the trajectories of these particles, turned around so much that they rent walking right here. So by the time they arrive, you see this type of distribution in the sky. Not very interesting. But eventually, at very high energies, we should start seeing them pointing back, which is what we see. Now, let me talk about the major observable, which is the spectrum. And this is a pretty interesting measurement, because it's I don't think there's some of my colleagues call it one of the wonders of nature, because it has 12 orders of magnitude in energy and 32 orders of magnitude in flux, and it pretty much looks like power law all the way down. So this is quite striking. Very few things, we don't know any other thing actually, that does this kind of, has this kind of job. So there are accelerators out there, or some other origin for these particles, which have this amazing non-thermal behavior. Most of other things in astrophysics are thermal, so this is definitely non-thermal. The best ideas are still dating back to stochastic shock acceleration by Fermi, with, you know, more interesting twists to them and very interesting nonlinear studies that are coming out now. But basically, you know, this is what we have. The good news about stochastic acceleration is that it does inject the spectrum of e to the minus 2, roughly. And what we see after propagation is some steepening of the spectrum. So it's not completely off that e to the minus 2.7 and e to the minus 3 are the kind of predictions you would have from a stochastic shock acceleration mechanism. Now, where are the shocks? Are the shocks in supernovae, clusters of galaxies? This is the big range. We don't know quite well. And also, there are some features in the spectrum. There is a knee, which you can barely see here, and an ankle that you can probably not see at all. And we expect to see a feature at the very highest energies from the interaction of pions, which is called the GZK effect, or the Bryson-Sepp-Pushman cutoff. Okay? So this is the best data in the field, let's put it that way. And I'll be focusing on the highest energy events, which we have a better spectrum that came out of Roger recently. But just to remind you, so what is involved in trying to explain such a thing is to have such a huge range of energy that fits this power law non-thermal spectrum, that you have maximum energy which reaches above 10 to the 20 electron volts. And that's really tough to do, as I'll show you in some simple arguments soon. And then you want to explain all these features. So the features are real. We love these features, because if we had none of that, we would be even more confused. Okay? So the fact that there is a tiny little feature here, but when you multiply by E cubed, you can actually see it quite nicely, this knee, might be telling us that the accelerator actually on the galaxy is changing. Ankle, which has the opposite type of change in slope, might be the fact that a new accelerator, for example, an extragalactic accelerator is coming in. And finally, the GZK cutoff was an expected fall-off due to the interaction with pions. So these features give us some clues about the accelerators, but also about the propagation and interaction. So by the time we measure this story on Earth, basically all these things happen. We had an accelerator and a propagation and some final interactions. on the way here and also in the atmosphere. And so to deconvolve that from what we have here is not so trivial. One thing to keep in mind is that the particles I'm interested in over here at highest energies have a center of mass much higher than the LHC. So we are talking about hundreds of TeV center of mass. So if you want to do your center of mass transformation, I helped you by putting one way to do it up there. Basically, for ZeV, which is 10^21, you have TeV center of mass if you're half in A. Okay, so that's how it scales. Okay, so as I mentioned, we might have some explanation for the spectrum up to the knee by some supernova shock acceleration in the galaxy theory. This is sort of the favorite theory among astrophysicists. And trying to use the cosmic rays themselves to prove this or disprove it is not so obvious because, again, it doesn't point back. It comes in the isotropic directions. You have a clue due to composition. You can look at that this is the total spectrum. You have actually different nuclei. So protons are dominant up just before the knee, and then there's a shift from protons to heavies. So this region over here is heavy dominated. And by heavy, we mean iron. And so maybe this is what's going on, that we have supernovae acceleration. But then maybe the cosmic rays, as I mentioned, are not the way to solve this issue because we have help from multi wavelength studies. For example, from Chandra, we have these beautiful images of supernovae shells that might be doing the cosmic ray acceleration. And even more high energy photons can tell us better about this idea. So, for example, the TV gamma rays that are seen in supernova remnants might be just the signature of these cosmic ray accelerations. So basically, by looking at photons at very high energies, and high energies in photons is TeV, not ZeV, as I was telling you about before, by looking at the photons here in their spectrum, you can tell if they are electronic, the electrons being accelerated, or hadronic type accelerators. Basically, the interactions of protons will give you gamma rays through pi-naught production. Well, you also have gamma rays through E plus minus directions, so you have to sort those through with different magnetic fields giving you the inverse Compton and the synchrotron radiation. So by trying to fit the spectrum in a wide range of electromagnetic observations of supernovae, you can tell what the difference. And basically, the data is coming out to say that it's probably cosmic ray acceleration going on. So that could be solved in a way in a few years. I think the evidence is pretty much accumulating in favor of that image, of that idea. So the idea would then be that there is a crossover to something else, which is the ankle is one of these features. It could be that this crossover is happening a little earlier at the ankle is due to E plus E minus production. So I'll show you why is that an interesting feature also. And so whatever is happening, we think that eventually these are extragalactic. Okay. And the reason is, if you get to 10 to the 20 electron volts, you don't expect the magnetic fields of the galaxy to be turning these particles around very much. So you know what the fields are roughly, Michael-Gauss fields. You know, you do your vacuum envelope for 10 to the 20 electron volts, you don't deviate very much for a proton. Unless these things are very, very heavy, very charged, you're likely to see basically the galactic plane if these things are coming from the galaxy. And since we don't see the galactic plane, they are probably extragalactic. Okay, so this whole range and energy here are likely to be extragalactic. But what are the accelerators? So there are many models in the market from JETs and AGN type accelerators. People talked about radio lobes being one site that would be nice to do the acceleration. And the reason for the radio lobes versus the central regions of AGN is because the central regions of AGN have a lot of photons around and they're easy destroying these protons to try and accelerate. So there is a real challenge over there. But it turns out from the data that I just showed you that the AGN that correlate are not AGN with big radio lobes. So this theory seems to be this favorite these days. Gamma ray bursts, for example, was another extreme. So these things are very, very large objects in the sky, and these are tiny, well, they're pretty bright, but they're compact objects which implode and might have an accelerator for a bursting period, so a short time. Now, we can't tell with the data that we have right now. So with this correlation with AGN, we cannot rule out the option of gamma bursts. Okay? It's difficult because we are seeing way too many of them within 100 megaparsecs, but it's not something we can easily rule out yet. I hope we will be able to tell them apart in the near future. Now, why is it so hard to do these accelerations? So, for example, if you, just for fun, estimate what radius you would have to have an LHC-type accelerator with LHC magnets to reach the energies we're talking about, then you would have to build one that goes from the Sun to Mercury. If you want the electric field from an LHC, you would have to go over to Saturn. So these are pretty big scales in the sense of funding by DOE. It's really impossible. It's pretty hard to do the ILC already as it is. So I showed you this analogy just to show you how we do sort of back of the envelope sorting through all the possibilities that are there out in the universe. We make an estimate of what magnetic field and the size of the objects are by, and you can to get maximum energy type estimates multiplied by CE. And what you want, so the 10 to the 20 for protons is the solid line, 10 to the 20 for iron is the dashed line, and the dotted line here is 10% efficiency. So you don't expect this to be a real proof, but it's basically a back of the envelope. So what you want is sources on this side of your line to be able to reach high energies. And what we find is that those sources are on this side of the line, most things that are out there that we know. Some of them can make it. So neutron stars, gamma ray bursts, AGN, and some galaxy clusters and radio lobes. So these are the things that we focus on. But basically, we don't know of any other objects that we could put easily on this side. So these accelerators have to be very efficient. And so it's hard enough to accelerate them. They have to be efficient, and they have to not be destroyed by the gamma rays around. So you have to find some extreme accelerator that's kind of quiet in the photon side. That's the challenge. Now, with these correlations with AGN, people are proposing many AGN-type models. They were in the market already before, but you probably see many more suggestions coming up in the literature. But the issue of energy losses is usually shoved under the rug. So, you know, just ask that question for your next model. So I hope this spectrum is clear, and let's focus on the highest energies. Okay, so here I really enjoyed this part of this whole story because finally you could do this particle astronomy business, really point back and start trying to pile up data from the sources themselves. Now, as soon as you start pointing back, nature is giving you another tricky change, which is the so-called GCK cutoff, right? It's a separate inclusion. Back in 66, when the microwave background was discovered, he said there would be an end, a cosmologically meaningful termination of the cosmic ray spectrum. Okay, at that time there's one suggestion of a data point at this very high energies, but we didn't really have the equipment to go test this idea very well. But the idea is very simple: protons at 10 to the 20 electron volts will see the microwave background as gamma ray background, will have delta resonance type interaction and create pions. These pions, so the first effect of this, that the proton that's left, the proton or the neutron that is left, will have less energy than the one that came in. So you will have a high energy proton move to a lower energy bin in your spectrum. So your spectrum will change and will have feature, will accumulate just before this cutoff and then die. Another thing that's very nice, so this is the bad news for proton detectors, but there's really good news for both gamma ray detectors and neutrino detectors, because these pions will give you a really nice flux of neutrinos and photons at very high energies. And at the energies we're talking about, the 20, the photons actually can start coming to us, because I don't know if you've heard much about gamma ray astronomy, but TeV gamma rays is sort of the limit in the energy scale, because the microwave background will take all the beautiful higher energy gamma rays that any accelerator might produce and eat them up, because similar interactions, but now photon-photon interactions. And basically, it's very hard to measure photons for the PEV region, which is why ice cube and other neutrino detectors are built around these energy scales. But when you get to the 20, the universe becomes nice again for photons, depending on the rate of background. So you can actually get your photons measured by, for example, Auger. So what are you going to be looking at? Not only the proton spectrum, but also the photons and the neutrinos at these very high energies. Here is the attenuation length and interaction length due to the pion production, and also this E plus minus interaction. So here are, in megaparsecs, what happens to your interaction. So for example, we don't really care about 10 to the 7 megaparsecs. You know, I most models of cosmology are still in the gigaparsec scales, but you know, some of you might care about big numbers in there than that. So gigaparsec scales, you know, means it comes from the whole universe. And then it dives down around between 10 to the 19 and 10 to the 20, all the way to 10 to the 1, which means that, you know, very quickly you get from the gigaparsec scales, many gigaparsecs, or the entire universe, to about 100 megaparsecs. Okay, so this very drastic change means that, so here are we going up in energy in the spectrum. At very low energy, 10 to the 15, going to the cube of the galaxy makes everything isotropic. Then at 10 to the 18, maybe things could become anisotropic if they were, say, coming from the galaxy, but coming from the whole universe. And the whole universe, 3 gigaparsecs of stuff, is pretty isotropic too. So you have two reasons to have isotropy at 10 to the 18, the end of the magnetic field influence, but also the beginning of looking at the whole universe as a whole, so the whole isotropic universe. But as soon as you get to 10 to the 19, somewhere in between here, and now we know that it's about 6 times 10 to the 19, the universe should start showing only 100 megaparsecs. And in 100 megaparsecs, we have a very anisotropic distribution. We have large scale structures that people have been measuring in the optical, very nice, right? Digital sky survey and such. So this is why we should predict, I mean, we had predicted that we'd see some anisotropy eventually, but we had no clue where the energy would be and how easy it would be to detect. And as I'll show you, it's not super easy. Okay, so the effect of the GCK is shown here in this plot, which summarizes different possibilities. So for example, you can put a source at different redshifts over here, so redshift 0.03 all the way to 0.2. And what this is showing you is what we call the modification factor, suggested by Brzezinski, which basically tries to summarize the effect of the GCK effect. So here, for a very nearby object, you basically have the ejection spectrum. So this modification factor is what you have to multiply your injection spectrum to get what you observe. Okay, so this is what the accelerator puts in, and then the propagation will make it look like one times the other. So for example, your acceleration is at e to the minus 2.2, you have to multiply this by minus 2.2. For a low redshift, you have very little change, and it changes, change comes in at about 10 to the 20. As you move up in redshift, the energy goes down because the microwave background is also redshifting. And you have pile up, which is a little bit more abrupt. And so when you actually have a distribution of sources, you have a distribution in redshift, and you have a smooth version of this effect. There's a nice little dip here, which is called fair production dip, and which might be an explanation for the angle. Okay, so there's two possibilities for the angle. Is the transition from galactic cosmic rays to extragalactic cosmic rays, or is it the plus minus dip? Okay? And one way to tell these two apart is to look at the composition right at that energy. Okay, so the GCK effect, as I mentioned just now, it gives these spectral features, which we expect to measure, and it should give you an isotropy in the sky. This is the spectral feature by hand, drawn just to show you how abruptly it should happen. But at the same time that you're losing, so this is this tricky business, at the same time as losing the flux, you're also starting to do particle astronomy. So it's quite fine-tuned in that way. Now, the first attempt to actually do a good measurement of this GCK feature was done by the Agassiz array, which was a Japanese experiment. And basically, they didn't find the GCK cutoff, which really made a lot of people related to people like you in this room, trying to find, you know, alternative explanations for these particles, because you expect something like, so here are two plots, one from Agassiz and the other from Hi-Rez, showing E cubed times the spectrum, okay, that you measure. So that you would expect E cubed would be a flat thing, so you would expect no change in slope of this plot, so basically a flat spot, a flat line, if you have a GCK cutoff, and you would expect something that goes down if you see a GCK cutoff. So you basically expect to see something like the blue line, and they measured this interesting excess over here. What these events gave a lot of press to our field, which was a nice thing to get funding, for example. But if you remember, maybe I didn't mention, but one of the very hard, I was mentioning this at lunch, I think, one of the very hard things to do is to measure energy very well in this business. I'll show you how we measure this thing soon. And an energy shift, this EQ times spectrum, will give you a diagonal shift in this line, these data points here. So if you're off by a little bit in the energy, you can make a big change in this plot. And they probably were either very somewhat off in their energy scale, which is the nicest explanation, or there's something very basically to understand about their detector. So I think the energy scaling is the easiest way to explain this, and they actually have a paper out recently, 2 years ago, trying to reanalyze this data and show that they do have a big systematic error in energy that would explain this thing away. But, you know, at the time, it was certainly surprising to most of us, and so it was very interesting to try to find different models that would explain how this spectrum was so, how this flux was so high. So these are the number of events. So 2 events, 3 events, and 6 events. Yeah. When you're getting to the end of your detectability, all kinds of weird things happen, right? Statistics is quite tricky. Here's the high-res spectrum. So this is one type of technique, which is the ground array, which was a ground array trying to look at showers. I'll show you how these things look like when we talk about Roger's soon. And this is a different technique, using the fluorescence telescope, looking at shower developing in the atmosphere. As the shower develops, particles from the shower excite nitrogen molecules in the atmosphere, and these things fluoresce. It's an ultraviolet bulb that you can detect. And so by looking at two different techniques, two different sites, this is in Utah, this is in Japan, they found different spectra. But if you look at the error bars in this data here, and what the error bars should be in this data here, they are consistent, okay? So statistically, there's not enough statistics to actually measure the blue line with confidence, and that's the problem. So you really need a big experiment. But controversy between these two measurements made a lot of us worry about this issue. So let me just, well, I think I wanted to jump to the Auger, but let me just remind you again, I think I said this in words, but this is just, so I'm going back on my, I had a slight software issue, so these things should have been a little bit earlier, but let me show you what this is, okay? So this is a calculation of the horizon that I showed to you before of protons, and I mentioned in words that by moving in energy between 10 to the 19 and 10 to the 20, you change from looking at a whole gigaparsec, many gigaparsecs, to very short distances, and this is just a calculation that shows that. At 10 to the 19.5, most of your events are coming from 10 to the 2.5 gigaparsecs, so close to gigaparsec. And when you get to 10 to the 20.3, you're at 1 megaparsec. Okay? So this is just showing again that the horizon within less than an order of magnitude in energy moves from gigaparsecs to tens of megaparsecs. And in tens of megaparsecs to 100 megaparsecs, you would expect to see structures like this. Okay, so this is a Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and you see big walls. So you should expect to see an anisotropies. And we had actually looked at an anisotropies assuming that... okay, sorry. I thought all of you had seen this so many times. Okay, so this is one of those wow shots that we should put mugs everywhere. This is us sitting here in a slice of the sky done by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Each dot is a galaxy, okay? And these colors tell you different things about the galaxies. But the thing you should take away from the shot is that each dot is a galaxy, and this is hundreds of megaparsecs, okay, in structure, 50s to hundreds of megaparsecs. So if you study large-scale structure distribution of galaxies in the universe, and these are the things that match very nicely with microwave background fluctuations. So you get, you know, this beautiful coherent picture that fits from quantum fluctuations exploded by inflation. This is the story you might want to tell your friends at Thanksgiving or something, becoming these humongous large-scale structure walls. And so we know the universe around, this is so data, so this is how the universe looks around in the northern part, actually. And we are looking in the south, but anyway, that's just a detail. We know that there are structures out there and things should show up. And one way to do this was to predict by just assuming that the ultra-energy cosmic rays are produced where the dark matter is, where the galaxies are, where all the gravitating objects are, and ask what the sky would look like as you move from 10 to the 20.5 to 10 to the 19.5. And this is how it would change. Okay, so these are predictions. Now I don't have to spend so much time on this because we have beautiful data. But this is what I used to show what we expect to see as you move up this is actually down in energy. So as down in energy, you have more bluish, meaning less of an isotropy. A few sources here and there might still be bright, but as you move to higher energies, it's very clear that the nearby structures give you a strong signal. Okay. All right. So summarize the same thing over again. The challenge is that you're really on a very steep falling spectrum, and right around those energy things are starting to become challenging. So, okay, now I want to talk to you about how to detect these particles and what the best observatory on this looks like, and that's the OG Observatory. Now, the OG Observatory, we're just finishing the subsite site, and it's an array of 3,000 square kilometers that I'll show you pictures of soon. When the observatory was proposed, people were bold enough to propose two observatories that they were supposed to be built at the same time, and fund the agency say, no, go to the south first, and then you can come to the north later. They were probably wise, because now we want to do something different on the north. We want to do something much larger and probably sparser, so that we focus on the energies above a few times 10 to the 19 electron volts, where we know the anisotropies are sitting at. Okay, so the south has given us the energy scale for the astronomy to begin. And now we can focus the north in doing the astronomy itself by taking a lot more data to make something 10,000 square kilometers or bigger up in the northern site. Okay, so we have about, it's a large collaboration for observatories, more than 300 PhDs, 7 institutions, and 17 countries. And collaboration meetings are a lot of fun. People actually get along. It's quite a model for the United Nations. This is just a small sample of the people actually meeting on the site. So this is how it looks like in the Argentinian Pampas. And as mentioned to you before, we use both techniques. The large detector on the ground, the 3,000 square kilometers, really refers to the ground detector. And then we have coverage on the sky of the fluorescence technique to look at the sky 10% of the time. So we actually cover the same area that the ground array in fluorescence telescopes, but they are only operating 10% of the time. So here's the beginning of the story. Okay, so a proton comes in, could be an iron nucleus, CNO, just stick something in between, unlikely to be something heavier than iron from an astrophysical point of view. We don't really know until we measure it, but let's say there's a charged particle coming through, has a hadronic type, it interacts in the atmosphere at some height, and then it develops a atmospheric air shower, which multiplies billions and billions of particles until it hits the ground. Now, you can see it's developing through this fluorescence that I mentioned to you. That's an ultraviolet light moving at the speed of light, so it doesn't look very much like anything else. It's quite easy to tell it apart from light and so forth. Although light does disturb Earth, and so if there is light, we don't observe, so that's for sure. Anyway, by the time the shower is developed up to the ground, depending on the energy and the interaction, and the direction, you get lots of these tanks. These are water tanks looking at Cherenkov radiation as the particles cross your tank. Okay? That will be pictured soon. But let me show you what the size of this thing is. So we have this whole area around the city of Malargue, which is in the Mendoza area close to Chile border in the Argentinian side. So we fly to Santiago, move over the Andes to Mendoza, and then drive down. This is beautiful wine area over here in Mendoza, and there's great meat also, so, you know, for the Bourbons in the audience, that's a good place to visit. And this is where all the tanks are supposed to be once we finish. We're very close. This is in December. We have, you know, hope to have 1,600 of these detectors in the very, very near future, maybe next month. And on them, they're different colors by showing which ones of them have actually. There we go. So there's right now 1,573 deployed, so we're very close to 1,600, which is the number to deploy the whole array. We have filled most of them with water, and 1,458 are taking data. Okay, so we have to deploy it in different steps, and some of the electronics is not on all the tanks yet, but it should be there pretty soon. This is what the detector looks like, and this is the entrance in the back. You basically have a tank of water with a GPS for timing, an antenna for sending the data to the nearby bigger antenna, and then to the central campus. And there's three photomultipliers. Actually, I have a picture that shows up. So before, this is another nice shot just to show you the distance between them. It's 1.5 kilometer distance between two tanks. Okay? So this you have to use a zoom to take. You can see the array here as it goes. It's very nice to see it at sunset, but sometimes you can have whole pieces of the array shining at you. And the reason they shine is because of the solar panels. So here's your water tank, the one of the PMTs. So this is looking down as the particles come through and emits rain of light. Solar power is all you have to play with because there are no electric plugs to plug this thing in. That would be more expensive than the whole experiment trying to wire this whole area. Let's see. We need to know the time very well. So we use GPS for timing as opposed to position, since hopefully these things don't move, unless cows are very strong and move them a little bit sometimes. But usually they don't. There's battery, and what else do we need to know? Not much. I guess that's the basics. A meter and a half. So a human being is just above that. And I used to have pictures like that with me around, but I thought it was not necessary. But you're right. It's probably better to have that. It's 1.5 meters. And this is what tank signals. So here's an event which lit up all the different tanks that are in dark blue. And each of these tanks give a signal like this. Okay, this is the PMTs firing. There are three colors for the three PMTs. And they're pretty much on top of each other. That's why you hardly ever see all the three colors, because they're showing the same data. And then you fit a lateral distribution function to that data. So you should basically know how much, how many particles, how much stuff was there at 2,000 meters from before, 2,000 meters, 3,000, so forth. So this is your lateral distribution, which gives you a measurement of the energy. Okay. Now, usually, very close to the core, you get so much stuff that basically you get overwhelmed by the data. So you don't actually have very good measurement right next to the core if you happen to have a tank there. So you have sort of this. And if you have very far away, again, you have trouble. So the lateral distribution function, which is our measure of energy, has sort of a sweet region over here, unless you have many, many tanks that you can get data for. So this is why a fluorescence detector gives us a better control of energy, is that this is a little bit indirect. There's some fluctuations. But here is an event which came very much from the vertical, and it's very symmetric on the ground. By contrast, and this is what a typical image from different PMTs looks like, basically a lot of stuff. Okay, and I want to contrast this with a vertical event, a horizontal event, which is this one. So you see it's very asymmetrical. It's coming in very close to the ground. And the signal is quite different. Okay, so if you want to know more detail about the signals, I'll be happy to explain to you. But I just wanted to give you an impressionistic view of the difference between this signal and the previous one, because that's relevant for when you're trying to measure neutrinos. So here is a shower which is hitting the ground that has both the electromagnetic and the muon content of the shower. Okay? As a shower of the same energy comes in a more inclined direction, it goes to a lot more atmosphere, so it loses all the electromagnetic part of this cascade, and it basically is a muon pancake, and that's what we're measuring here. Now, by knowing what part of that is muon, what part of that is electromagnetic, we can tell what the composition is. Okay. And as you see, it doesn't match any of the theories. So there's something interesting going on. Because we have this ability of separating the two components, it's closer to a LHC type detector, which has muon detectors and electromagnetic detectors. We can use basically the inclination in the atmosphere to try to separate these components and try to contrast that with predictions from hadronic models. And they don't match. So if there's interest in physics, that might be one of the clues. The fluorescence detectors sit on hills that overlook this flat area where the array is. And they basically have this 180-degree type structure, 30 degrees per telescope. So there are really many telescopes in there, six of them with mirrors and such. So let me take you inside. So here's the opening to the sky. You only open this at night when the moon is not out, dark moonless nights. One grad student opened during the day and destroyed one of his campus. We've never seen him since. I haven't seen him since. Anyway, the mirrors reflect the light coming through, and then the camera over here is a different type of camera because, you know, if you're doing optics, optical astronomy, you like CCDs that pile up your photons as they're coming through, and every photon is a very precious thing. Here, we get rid of, we don't have huge efficiency in gathering all the photons that are emitted, but we have to have very fast detectors, so PMTs are the way to go. And basically, each, you know, this signal is ultraviolet photons moving at the speed of light from one second to the next, so you have to be very quick. Okay, so PMT camera is the way we do this. And I'll show you what it looks like soon as the data. But this is a picture of the four different detectors which overlook the whole array. So you have 1,600 tanks with four telescopes looking at the same array, so you can see 10% of the time. The 10% comes from dark sleepless nights, okay? So, because the rest of the time you can't observe with these telescopes. Yep. And so here, photo multiplier tubes. I'm so happy to have a translator. yeah, so please keep doing this if something is not obvious. Nowadays, I'm more used to these things than I used to be. Okay. So here's a hybrid event, which is the both types of detectors look at the same event. Okay, so this is one of the novelties. So Auger is designed to do the best job ever in this field by two different things. One is the largest, so you have large statistics, because as you saw in the spectra that I showed you from high res and a gas, the error bars and the statistical errors are huge, plus the systematic errors are not even shown on those plots. So you don't want to be ruling out models when your error bars are way too large, or trying to understand something or claiming that don't fit the decay effect and so forth when you don't really have the right statistics. So we want to make it very large, the statistics is high, so we have lots of events above 10 to 19 electron volts. But we also want to know the energy very well. We want to know that we are above 10 to 19 electron volts. So the way to do that is to have large array, but also have both techniques look at the same events. Because with 10% of the events being seen by the eye, being seen by these cameras, which is what's shown over here, you can get a very good energy calibration. And then you can use the statistics of the ground array, which is on all the time, to get the very large number of events. So you have both control of the systematics and the statistics on the data. Here is one shower seen by two different cameras. So this is these little honey cobweb things. Are the camera PFTs projected into the data. This is the actual fired ones. And this is a timing match between, so the green on the bottom is the data from the tanks. So a shower developed in the sky, hit the ground, is seen both by these cameras and by the ground. And then we have redundant information that we can use to fit the energy scale very nicely. And this is what the shower looks like as it develops the atmosphere. This is the atmospheric depth. It goes up and down. Now, the way this thing goes up and down in atmospheric depth is one way to measure composition. A proton of one energy versus an ion of the same energy will have different development. Okay, so the maximum of the shower, which is what we call X max, because this is usually shown as X, the atmospheric depth is an X in grams per centimeter squared. The X max, maximum of this shower, tells us if these things are likely to be protons or ions. Also, the fluctuations between different X max, different showers for the same energy. So a proton will fluctuate a lot more for a given energy because you have stochastic probability that it won't interact the first time it can, it will interact the second or third time. While an iron nucleus is a big ball thing, it tends to interact at the same depth more often, okay, for the same energy. These are all energy-dependent statements. And one nice thing about having four telescopes, that from time to time you have a shower, so this is the array, and four of the telescopes look at the same effect. So you have hybrid with four eyes, or four stereo type. It's not really stereo anymore, but you have four. So these are beautiful data that we can use to understand energy scale and distribution of the sky and so forth, much better than previous experiments. So we're, you know, an order of magnitude above everybody else that did this work before. So the hybrid technique gives us energy which is independent of A and M. A being the atomic number, and M being, what is M? The energy, the mass, and A is, sorry?
Is over here.
Oh, good, good.
Hadronic model.
Thank you. This is very important. Yeah. And of course,
I wonder how I got this. But I know where I got this from. This is from our spokesman. He likes M. Okay, so M is for hadronic model. And basically, if you had so remember Agassi when I showed you there was this mismatch
with the GCK cutoff. To get the energy scale there, they really only have the ground array showing you the footprint. To really have shower development and know where the x-max is, they have to use a hadronic model. That's where M comes in. Okay. And so when you have S only, it becomes dependent on the hadronic model and is also dependent on if it's iron or proton. If you have FT, then it's independent on this because you actually see the whole shower. FT is fluorescence detector and SD is surface detector. Sorry about the exact names, I should have written them out. So FD, so the fluorescence technique, has positive, many positives. It sees the whole shower, so you don't have to assume a shower development. If the footprint, you can see the whole thing as it develops. The aperture is a difficult thing. This means that the size of your detector is very hard to know because it depends on clouds, for example. So you're looking out at the sky, and you think you see X amount of atmosphere, but maybe it's foggy, maybe you have pollution, maybe you have clouds, so your detector is changing every night. That's not very nice, okay? While the SD, which is the surface detector, is very independent of aperture, meaning it's just a geometric thing. Anything that lands within that area will be detected. So it's really easy. So this is one of the pluses. The other plus of the SD is the fact that you have a lot more events because it's on all the time. It's not on 10% of the time. Okay, and then you have angular resolution, which depending on if you only have one SD, which is if you have one telescope, you have a very large error. When you combine two or more FTs, you can get a little bit better. But when you have SD and the FT, you get 0.2 degrees. This is not impressive from astronomers' point of view, but for us, it's quite impressive. Okay. So with this beautiful machine, we want to know the energy spectrum, composition, and derived direction distribution. And as I told you before, all kinds of fun things will come from that. So let's jump to the results. So results on the spectrum, I should actually be concluding, I can see now, but let's very briefly what's going on. So the spectrum looks like this. Let's jump ahead to this plot. Okay. I'll be a tiny bit over any prompt chair. So here's a red line of what to expect. It did not have the GCK cutoff. Okay. So the bottom line that you take from this plot, you don't have to read all the stuff unless you care about details, so I'll give you that later. But what you want to read is significance six sigma that data is below the red line, which means that we're likely to be seeing the GCK cut. Now, if this was the only data we had, it would be hard to prove that it's only the GCK cutoff and not the maximum energy of the accelerator. Remember, the galactic accelerator might have maximum energy that, supernova acceleration and so forth are running out when the extragalactic one is coming in. That's why, how I explained the angle, maybe. Here, it could be that the accelerator is running out of energy just when we thought the GCK cutoff would come in. So how do you tell these two apart? Well, you look at the anisotropies. If it's really the GCK, you should be seeing 100 megaparsecs and not the whole universe. And that's how we get to solve the problem. So I'll jump these things. Just with the spectrum alone, the tip, the angle, is interesting. But as I mentioned to you before, it could be explained by E+C- interaction or by a transition from one type of accelerator, the galactic one, to the extragalactic one. And for that, we need to do the composition. So, composition. I mentioned to you that different low A and high A will have different maximum of the showers. This is my shower development with different maxima. And at low energies and high energies, they also shift around. So for a given energy, so if you sit at one fixed energy, you can tell different composition, low A and high A, by looking at where the maximum is and how the fluctuations about the maximum, large fluctuations and small fluctuations. And here are predictions from all our beautiful models of protons only and iron only for the x-max, so to the ground is upwards. So the max of the shower are closer to the ground as you go up in x. And this is an energy scale over here. And these are all the hadronic models that I've mentioned to you before. That's my spokesperson likes to call M. So these are the sort of range of uncertainty that the best modelers put up in our board, and the data looks like that. Now, this is interesting. It does look like either proton or iron. That's okay. It could be a mixture, so it's moving from proton, say, from iron-rich to proton-rich. Well, it was moving to proton-rich, and then it turned around to iron-rich, and then who knows what's going on here. because this is really high energies, and we expect to be proton dominated at the highest energies, and we see correlations at the highest energies. So something is very off. Okay, and this is just one of these indications that, okay, hadronic collapses are very hard. Okay, these are forward direction things, so people, you know, that are used to LHC kind of interactions have to look in the PT, in the transverse direction. They have to look down the pipe. They're looking down the pipe. So it's pretty hard. I mean, these guys work hard. But basically, who knows what's going on? It's not at all what we expect. It's best at the highest energies, okay? Over here, you can argue that there's a mixture. There's some CNO mixed in there, some helium, and so forth. But over there, at the highest energies, we would expect these lines to be very close to the red. Now, what's going on? I don't have an answer yet. The data looks just like what we expected from other previous experiments, so it's consistent with previous experiments, but we have much smaller error bars, and we're reaching higher energies. So we're doing a good job. We also see a lot more muons than we expect, which is consistent with this, you know, this picture here. You can say that it's really iron, or very heavy stuff that is showing up the highest energies, which is inconsistent with the correlations that we see with AJN. Or there are lots of something that gives you many muons, which would look like iron of this too. Okay? So it's basically a lot of hadronic interactions than you expect.
No, photons are over very high.
Next.
This is photons. Okay, so iron, protons, and the photons are,
I think. So by looking at the same data, we can put a limit on how much of this thing is actually photons, okay? And photons are a little bit tricky because if you think, well, details about how to analyze photons later because I don't have time, but have to shift the energy around a little bit. But basically, we can have a limit on the photon fraction, and that's what you use to make at least one person in this room not super happy, which is rule out super heavy dark matter candidates. So when the spectrum was giving us trouble by having way too much flux at the highest energies, people proposed that dark matter could be decaying and explaining the highest energy points. Okay? Now, if dark matter decays, say, in the halo of our galaxy, you will be dominated by photons, because if you take anything from very high energies and you just try to make it go down to low energies, you create a lot more pions than you have protons around. So you have, for each proton, 10 photons from the pions. So you have to be very photon dominated for most of the models. And so by having a limit on the photon fraction, you pretty much can rule out these models. Now, another option is to have topological defects, cosmic strings, things like that. These are not necessarily in the halo of our galaxy, so you distribute them throughout large scale structures, so they correlate like the AGN do. And the other nice feature about these models is that the photon fraction gets lowered by the propagation. At the source, you still have photon dominance, but then the photons get eaten up by the equivalent to the GCK cutoff by pion flux. So topological defects actually can survive, but not for very long, because we have neutrino limits. So the photons get eaten up, but the neutrinos don't. And the neutrino limit is getting pretty close to killing these models too. But they're still doable. And in the future, this is just a plot showing you what the GCK neutrinos prediction looks like, and different experiments, including Auger, which are pink things, coming down and detecting the neutrinos from the GZK interaction. So things like topological defects would definitely either detect or doubt. Now, to finish, I just wanted to remind you the anisotropies and that implications of that. So what we see with an angular resolution of 1:3 is no large-scale structure. So for those of you that were interested in the galactic center, a dipole, other objects that we might be seeing as galactic isotropy, we have no signals such as those that we expect to see. You know, for example, from super heavy dark matter, you would expect to see a dipole. We see no dipole to the level that we can measure within above 1 eV. We see no excess from the galactic center, from objects that would also have sources of the galactic center. And we see no signals from VLX. These are things people had proposed before, and other experiments had claimed to see to the two sigma level something. But what the cover of science was that we do have first evidence for an isotropy. Now, this is this correlation that I mentioned to you before with what's called 12 Veronsetti-Veron catalog. Okay, so these two people, Veronsetti and Veron, are married. That's why they have one name equal. And they basically pile up every claim of an AGN into a big catalog. But it's not a survey, so it has no beautiful statistical properties of, you know, equal anything. It's basically a pile up of the everything in the literature, so it mixes radio detection with optical detection with people who look down in one direction. So it's not very nicely well behaved enough to do very nice statistics for this, but it turns out to be complete enough within 100 megaparsecs to really put the signal on the map. Okay, so we were somewhat lucky that this thing actually came screaming out when we did this correlation. So there are two ways to do, and there are probably more than two, but two sort of generic ways to do an isotropy study. One is to look at the data itself and do tests of isotropy versus an isotropy. But since we have one sky, you can always claim that, well, it looks a little anisotropic, but how for sure. And then there's the other way, which is the cross-probe without the maps. And we've done both of these things, and this is the strongest signal we get. But we also get anisotropic signals anyway. So, for example, if you look at the equal, so this is just by eye, you can do your own anisotropy test here. If you look by eye at distribution in equal, this is a plot of equal exposure, and you see that it does not look like it was randomly thrown around. Okay? It doesn't scream at you as being a one big structure, but it does seem to have some sort of coherence in some regions. Okay? This is the way we want to show this data. In blue is the exposure, so this is the place exposed most in the observatory, and as you move towards this line, you get weaker and weaker exposure, and that's just due to our geographic location. When we build the north, we hope to fill in this area and have, you know, equal exposure throughout the whole sky. In red is this AGN catalog, which shows beautiful structures like the local supercluster. In that is the local supercluster, which is a big wall around us here within 100 megaparsecs. Okay? And in these circles here are our data. And what you find is that within 3 degrees, they basically hit an AGN most of the time. And some of them, they even hit twice the same AGN, for example, Sen A, which is in white over here. And Sen A, Centaurus A, is one of the closest active AGN around, so it's sort of a light source. So it might be the first source detected. Now, those of you who care about statistics and how to put penalties to scans and the data and so forth, we'll have to know that what we did was the following. We did scans on the three parameters that define these kinds of correlations. And in the angular, so the angular distance that we are going to use between our events and any other source, so, you know, from some 0 to 5 degrees or even bigger, but the maximum of our correlation is about 3 degrees. The redshift in the catalog, and the maximum is for redshift less than 0.018, which gives a distance of 75 megaparsecs. This is the 100 megaparsecs number I was throwing around roughly. And then in the energy, what energy threshold does this signal become significant? And the energy threshold is about 56 eV. 56 eV is just when the spectrum, if this is again our spectrum, it's really the deviation from continuing on a cube type spectrum. And this is just around the energy that the spectrum starts to dive. So it fits very nicely with the idea that it's the GCK cutoff. And as I mentioned to you before, even Berenstedt and Berenstedt themselves say, do not use this catalog for statistical analysis, which we went ahead and did anyway. So because we had looked at many catalogs and we had done these scans over all kinds of parameters, you can imagine that penalties could be large from statistical penalties from doing this. So what we did was to write a prescription. We say, okay, we maximized these parameters, we don't move them anymore, and we double the data. And I won't go through all this because I'm running out of time. But basically, we had in the first step, when we actually allowed ourselves freedom to look at every single catalog and so forth, 12 of the 15 events above 56 eV were closer than 3.13 from AGN in this catalog. Okay, while 3.2 were expected, so 12 instead of 3.2. So what we said was, let's double the data and make a prescription a priori that if we see X amount in the next X amount of data, Y amount of data, we will set a 99% confidence level that this is real, given if it correlates or not, right? So we're playing roulette every time it was a high energy event, trying to find if it correlates or not. And it turns out it passed our prescription. So we have the next round, 13 correlated out of 2.7 expected, okay? And that made the prescription fast, and we were very happy to write a paper then. So we wrote a paper saying there's very significant correlation. There are many other tests. They're coming out in papers right now. We have one out that already gives you more depth, more information on this analysis, and some that will be coming out hopefully in the next week or two, showing other tests on isotropy, and they're all consistent. We're very convinced that there is an isotropy there. We're also convinced that this is one of the nicest signals, is this VCV catalog correlation. But we're not convinced yet that AGN do accelerate photoenergy cosmic rays, which is one step that takes a while to take, because you know many things correlate with AGN, as I mentioned to you before. So it may be other things, and we're not trying to plan what to do in the future to try to figure out what really are the sources. So here's another map of the same thing, and you can see our data much nicer in this way, the red dots and the blue are the AGN. And you see the Centaurus A region, which has many events. For those of you who know your way around in the universe, Virgo, it seems to be a little bit empty, which is an interesting maybe clue. I don't understand it. I showed you this before. So one thing we can do, we cannot say it is AGN, but we can say that it isn't these other things. So these we already didn't think they would be there in the game, but very large objects, for example, galaxy clusters, shocks. These things are very rare within 100 megaparsecs. The number density of these things are very low, and we see way too many sources to be such an explanation. So we can start ruling out explanations for these sources. So, and then I'm sure you'll see many, many papers trying to use AGN proposed models. So let me close by saying that we are not seeing top-down model type expectations. So, you know, I just mentioned beating a dead horse because we already had the photon limit. We do not expect these things to be galactic accelerators because they don't sit so the galaxy at its highest energies. They're not supposed to be that distant that wouldn't have many of them within 100 megaparsecs. So these are the generic conclusions of this data. But we are right here now seeing the beginning of the story, and we're hoping to build Oceanoris, and other people are hoping to build GEM, OZO, and other satellites to look at these things and be able to go to much lower, much higher statistics, so you can actually get many, many events per source. So this is what we hope to do in the next decade. Thank you. Whoa, sorry.
The energy of the GCK cloud on the radius of which you expect these things not to be able to propagate, that comes from just considering photons, but now you think it's something fixed. So does that affect the radius of the energy that you would have?
Right.
That's what it made it tough.
Yeah, so it's a good question. Right, so the composition shows heavies. What about, this is what you're asking, right? What about the heavies in the GCK cutoff? So the heavies are this way. If you look at the horizon for protons, it's what I showed you. If you look at helium, they have much shorter horizons. They're photodisintegrated at much shorter distances, so it's not likely to be helium. CNO is a little bit shorter also, but iron is back to where the protons are. So if you actually have iron source, it's not impossible, plausible that there could be the sources, but two things. One is that the horizon is the same size, so that part is okay. But then we have events coming through the galactic plane in different directions. Well, that let's say a little bit above the galactic plane, but we don't see AGN in the galactic plane for for observational reasons. But we know what the fields are in that direction, and so if the correlations are as strong as we see they seem to be, then they're unlikely to be iron, because the fields in the galaxy alone would make 10-degree deviations from where they come from, so it doesn't look very likely. On the other hand, you could inject iron and get photons because they photo-associate, so they're still proton-dominated even if you have injection. So it doesn't tell you what the source composition looks like yet, but it does tell you that the observed one on Earth is very proton dominated. Which is not what we see in the showers, which is where the interest is. Yeah.
What are the cloud statistics of the events you expect to see per year? You are 56 eV once the.
About 15 a year.
About 15 a year.
Yeah. So this is basically 2 years of data. 2 years of full data. One was many more years, but it was construction time. and then 1 year, well, not full yet. So the integrated aperture that we've got up to now, the integrated exposure rate,
is about 2 years of full vision. So basically, every year we'll be, every 2 years we double the data.
And that's why we want to do a bigger dive, because we want to look faster than that. If you want to have a spectrum of the source, it seems a little bit too slow.
So in the lifetime of the array, which was projected to be about 30 years, if I remember correctly, when do you expect to really see the pile up, the, say, 3 sigma level, which would really confirm the expected feature?
The pile up in the spectrum?
Yeah, the pile up in the spectrum, just below the
spectrum. Well, the spectrum, actually, you could probably...
So the pile up will depend on what you injected, what the maximum energy is, and all kinds of other fun things. And that's why you want to know when to measure it well, right? So depending on the inputs, depending on what the real source is, I think we will see it much shorter than that, because the pileup will be at lower energies, and we have tons of events there. If you want to do astronomy, then you are in trouble, because you will have to wait 2 years to get something of the data. But if you want to just look at the spectrum at 10 to 19, we should be fine. We should have very small error bars
in the next couple of years. Don't have to do 30s.
You say you expect superhead podcast. Question one, what does superhead mean? Two.
So much heavier than WIMPs, for example. So these things have to be 10 to the 20 something electron volts
mass to be able to decay to 10 to the 20 protons.
10 protons. So not the usual
part of it. Cross-sections, you know, for width, which is lower in mass, 10 to 10 minus 4 seconds squared. So there's a regular interaction between or anything. Why would you expect this?
Yeah, so the people proposed that,
and they will remain nameless because some are present. Just kidding. Basically, the idea is to get decay for very high masses, so, you know, 10 to 25, say, EV. And make decay. So you don't make these dark matter particles come to the atmosphere and shower. You make them decay, produce protons and photons, and then you observe the usual thing. So the composition will be normal. Well, it wouldn't be any iron there, but would be, you know, photon dominated and then some protons and neutrons.
Next up, the last question. Yeah.
So you began by showing this curve, which is almost on the log log plot, almost a straight line. Mm-hmm. It has these tiny pieces. But now you're saying in the best models, the sources are quite different for different sections of the curve. So the deep features are tiny. So is that just an artifact of the log log plot, or does it really require some sort of coincidence in multiplicity of different sources to make it almost straight?
Right. So the reason I like the ankle being a new source feature versus an E plus minus dip is because it makes this issue less of a headache, because you have a spectrum going like this and another one coming at some random angle, right? And so this, an ankle will be generated that way. Well, if you have the transition, and this would be, say, a transition from, you know, galactic over here going down, extragalactic coming up. If you want to do what Berzinski wants, for example, to have the E plus minus dip be here, you have to match some other place, and this, they claim to be the second knee, but you know, it's really have to be fine-tuned, or you have to put some, well, it's always fine-tuning, but an extra parameter, a minimum energy that just matches. So I would agree with you, it's a little bit uncomfortable to have such a straight line meaning two completely different things. Some people have also suggested they're all gamma ray bursts. and these are the extragalactic ones. This is some that happened in our galaxy. But then, you know, why? This is not as easy to fit either. So, but I agree. It is quite a striking feature.
Okay. Thank Angela again. Okay.